Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence who is kind enough to share it with us weekly is our friend Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia, and that of a great many other places, by the way, including The Daily Beast, where he is a columnist, and Fox News, where he is a regular contributor, among other outlets. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You have, of course, been following very closely, as have we all, to greater or lesser degrees, I think, the president's travels in Asia. China, most especially, made a point of rolling out the red carpet in a very visual way. How warm was the actual welcome, though, Gordon? And where do you think it leaves us with respect to Sino-American relations at the moment?
Yes, the Chinese actually put on what they call a state visit plus for President Trump. I guess they were trying to appeal to his vanity, as many people have said. I actually don't think that it really worked because there really was not a change in American policies with regard to China. So, for instance, the Chinese did not want the United States to continue to sell arms to Taiwan. But the readouts are essentially that we're going to continue to sell weapons to the island. Also, the United States was talked to the Chinese about their Ministry of State Security agents operating on U.S. soil inappropriately. The U.S. told them to stop that. And the administration said it was not going to return people that China considered to be fugitives to Beijing. So that was a good thing. Now, there was a lot of pomp and circumstance. There was a little bit of talk on North Korea, of course. The president, after meeting Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, said that Xi was going to increase sanctions on North Korea. We'll see if that's the case. And then there was the announcement of $250 billion of transactions with regard to China. A lot of that is deals that have not been documented by firm contracts. And some of these transactions are only going to have an effect in the future. So there's a lot that went on. But I actually think that to a large extent, there was no real change in Chinese policy towards the United States or American policy towards China.
Gordon, in addition to China, of course, the president has been visiting five nations, some of them close allies like the Japanese and South Koreans. After he visited China, he stopped in Vietnam. He's now in the Philippines. Give us a flavor of the conversations in all of those places, as best you can discern them, about North Korea. I know China and trade were also part of the conversations in each capital, but what in particular do you think is the status with respect to North Korea in terms of regional attitudes and U.S. relations?
Yeah, North Korea was the topic of conversations on the first three stops. That's Tokyo, Seoul, and Beijing. The success he had in Tokyo was baked in. That was always going to be the case because relations between the United States and the Japan are particularly warm at this time. And the conversations about North Korea, I thought, went very well. What also went very well but was not baked in were the conversations in Seoul, because President Moon Jae-in, who's quite pro-North Korean, pro-China, actually, I think, warmed up to President Trump. We saw that with that attempted joint visit to the demilitarized zone between Presidents Moon and Trump. It didn't actually take place because the fog prevented both leaders from getting there, but that was only a detail. What it showed the North Koreans and the Chinese is that South Korea is not defecting from the U.S., and that's really a good thing. So I think we can chalk that up to President Trump's effective diplomacy in Seoul. I don't think things went that well in Beijing, as I just mentioned. And in the rest of the trip, is more about trade and just the region in general rather than North Korea.
We'll be talking in a moment with Kevin Freeman about the trade piece of it too, but let me get your thoughts on it, Gordon. I know that you were one of the supporters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's a lot of talk now that China has filled the void and the United States is going to be left out in the cold. The bilateral conversations that the president was trying to foster with a number of the countries in the region aren't panning out, and that we're now looking at trying to basically worm our way back into some variant on TPP, if not the original deal. Give us your thoughts on how that stands at the moment, Gordon, as these conversations are playing out in the Philippines at the moment, the ASEAN and East Asian Summit conferences.
The 11 other nations in the Trans-Pacific Partnership are trying to hammer together a deal. It's not going to be the same high-quality arrangement that it would have been if the United States were there, but China is not going to be able to get into it. What has made the United States so attractive to countries in the TPP was really the strength of the American market, and that hasn't gone away. And matter of fact, under President Trump, we've seen two very good quarters of GDP growth, 3.1% and 3.0%. So that is an indication that the U.S. is going to remain the dominant economy. Now, we're not going to be able to tie the region together through trade as a TPP would have permitted us to. But if the president does actually go forward on these bilateral trade deals, we will still be able to tie the region to us. The one thing where President Trump, I think, should get credit is he's raising issues that other people have not been willing to talk about. And that is, a lot of these Asian economies remain closed as a practical matter, not because of their tariff rates, which have actually come down, but because bureaucracies have prevented foreign companies from effectively competing in home markets. This is something that Trump raised. We saw it in the communique for the APEC meeting, which was held in Da Nang.
And in terms of the relationship with, in particular, Gordon, the Chinese, as they increasingly assert themselves, as we talk about a lot here, the South China Sea and to some extent the East China Sea as well, are those features of these conversations with the Asian governments, given that it has to have such an ominous overtone for all of their conversations about the trade that takes place in those waters and airspace?
Surprisingly, there was no mention of the South China Sea in the initial indications of the meeting between President Trump and President Duterte of the Philippines. I'm sure that they must have discussed it because this is the most critical issue facing the Philippines. And President Duterte talked about China before he met President Trump all of these territorial and sovereignty issues. The important thing here was that President Trump seemed to get along very well with his Philippine counterpart. I would have liked to have seen Trump talk about human rights in public, because as Senator John McCain said, our interests are our values and our values are our interests. But I can understand Trump not wanting to do that because he feels that he needs the Philippines in a very crucial time. So we will only know about a lot of this afterwards, because I think that a lot of the initial reports probably are not accurate. And it's going to take a little while for us to figure out what actually went on in some of these bilateral meetings and in some of these multilateral discussions. But as you point out, yes, territorial sovereignty issues are going to be at the top of people's concerns, whether they mention them or not.
Lastly, Gordon Chang, let me ask you, you have been very assertively promoting the importance of India in all of this. I've been struck by the continuing reference to the Indo-Pacific region in the course of this trip. Is that message, do you think, now being made part of American policy?
Absolutely, Frank. Starting with the briefings that, for instance, H.R. McMaster gave before President Trump left for the region, I mean, the use of the Indo-Pacific is striking because in the past, American officials always talked about the quote-unquote Asia-Pacific. Well, now no longer. And it means that our view of the region is bigger because obviously we're talking now about the Indian Ocean. So because we're now seeing it anchored on the other side by another large democracy. The Chinese have certainly got the message. People in the region have gotten the message. And this, I think, is a very good development as we're now thinking about India as a partner in what we are doing in the Asia Pacific and in the broader region, including the Indian Ocean.
It is a hopeful sign. We'll be looking forward to more of those retrospective looks at what has come out of all of this, Gordon Chang, when the president returns, and you do as well next week. Thank you in the meantime for your time today and for the great work that you do at The Daily Beast and Fox and elsewhere. I know you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you. Next up, we will be speaking with Kevin Freeman, as promised. Take a talk with him about this Asia trip and also what is going on in the way of economic warfare at the Persian Gulf. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, one of our senior fellows at the Center for Security Policy, an internationally recognized warrior in the economic warfare space, certainly a specialist in those matters. Witness his two best-selling books on the subject, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and his first, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And we'll be returning to that topic in just a moment. Kevin is also the founder of globaleconomicwarfare.com, a truly go-to resource on all of these issues. Kevin, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
I was just talking with our friend Gordon Chang about his take on the president's travels in Asia. I'd like to get yours.
You know, I think the president achieved a few things. He got some business deals, but what he did and the approach he took to the trip underscores the notion that we've been talking about for some time, that we tend to look at the globe as a marketplace, and our enemies perceive it as a battle space. And so he comes home talking about, I got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of trade deals, and I applaud him for working on the trade deficit. It's important. I applaud him for confronting hard issues. But the Chinese have been and will likely continue to steal us blind economically. They view this as a war. We view it as a business deal.
And evidence that they are stealing us blind was not front and center in the course of these conversations, as best I can take it, but certainly had to have been in the backdrop, notably buying up our technologies and stealing what they can't buy, and terms of trade relations with American companies that are highly, highly prejudicial, I think it's fair to say. Is that about it, or am I missing something?
That's about it. And if the president is able to get them to come to the table, not in the midst of an unrestricted war, which is what they've been doing, and treat us as trading partners, that would be a huge positive. I just didn't see that he made that progress on this trip.
Yeah, I fear not either. And in fact, there is reason to believe that the Chinese are continuing to beaver away at an effort you've described with us frequently, Kevin Freeman, and that is the effort by the Chinese, the Russians, and others to supplant our currency. Speaking of currency operations and manipulation, I did want, though, to turn to another subject you're following closely, Kevin Freeman, and that is what appears to be the United Arab Emirates' economic, or at least financial, warfare against Qatar. What are we to make of that?
Well, we know this because there was a leak to the Intercept newspaper that demonstrated that there was an effort based on a cyber theft of the United Arab Emirates ambassador to the United States. They hacked into his email account, found an email from a bank laying out a very detailed PowerPoint plan. This is how we could take Qatar down using financial warfare. The same kind of attack that I believe that Qatar used against the United States in 2008.
Irony of ironies, isn't it? Does this suggest that the UAE may have learned about these techniques from their Qatari neighbors?
Well, it's possible. What they're talking about doing to Qatar is essentially bidding up the credit default swaps, making it impossible for them to sell debt and to manipulate the yield curve in such a way that they're forced to defend their currency and they spend their sovereign wealth reserves defending their currency and defending the peg to the dollar. These are the same kind of things that we talked about that were used against the United States, used against Lehman Brothers in particular. And so they likely have learned it from that process. We've learned a lot since 2008. I guess other nations have learned a lot. Here in the United States, we tend to be naive about these sorts of things. But full-out economic warfare is underway right now, and this is further evidence of that.
So around the world, if not directed at us, we'd best be alive to the fact that it is also being directed at us, as you have indicated. Let me ask you about a particular vulnerability that I know you're quite seized with in terms of our debt and pensions and the possibility that they might be targeted for economic warfare by enemies in the future.
In 2013, there was a U.S. official that came out and said, if we don't arrest our spending habits, we're going to exceed our gross domestic product with debt, total outstanding debt of the federal government, and we might do it as early as 2024. Well, that would be where debt is greater than 100% of GDP, which is important because if you think about it, if your debt is greater than your salary in a whole year, it's kind of hard to manage the debt. Well, our government's debt is now 105% of our gross domestic product. So here we are 7 years beforehand and 5% over the horrible target that was projected. That just puts us in a weak position for other nations that want to take advantage and manipulate that debt, dethrone our currency, and all the things that we've talked about puts us in Qatar's position on the receiving end of some pretty nasty economic warfare. And it will hit individuals. It doesn't just hit the government. And that's the problem that we have with state and local pensions that are underfunded. If governments can't fund their pension with a roaring stock market and interest rates as low as they are today, they will never be able to fund those pensions in a recession. And that's kind of the big nasty that's out there that few people are willing to talk about now.
Yeah, that would presumably pale by comparison to the effects of higher interest rates, which would be a very predictable result if our currency is removed from its current vantage point of the reserve currency of the world, would it not?
Oh, absolutely. And those are mutually reinforcing factors. It's a nasty cycle that starts when higher interest rates cause recessions, which lend to higher interest rates, because normally recessions lend to lower interest rates. But in this case, when you have a currency collapsing and so forth, it's a death spiral. And what happens is that you counted on this pension that was promised by your city or by your company. You've been counting on that pension and you realize all of a sudden they're broke, they're out of money and they can't pay it.
Kevin, one of the things that some people are concerned might contribute to the deficit, or at least to our debt, is the tax reform bill that is now being mulled in Congress. I guess there's two different versions of it, one in the Senate, one in the House. Have you had an opportunity to look at those and think about whether they're new potential contributors to some of the underlying economic vulnerabilities that you're worried about?
Well, when you look at tax reform, the scoring people never look at the dynamic effects. They always look at the static effects. And the assumption is that it's just going to increase the debt because you're receiving less money in income. The structure of the tax reform is what's essential. And if we don't reform our corporate tax structure, we will continue to lose businesses overseas if we don't repatriate and so forth. So to the degree that we include tax repatriation, U.S. companies that have earned money overseas that are not bringing it back because they don't want to pay the high tax rates on it. If we lower the tax rates and allow them to bring that money home, that actually will shore up our economy. And that's where I'm holding out hope, because that is our weapon back in the dollar fight that could put us in there's $2 trillion that our companies have earned that they're holding in banks overseas. If they bring that back to the United States, we can grow our way out of this. We can win this economic war. So that's the big carrot. And correcting corporate taxes is another issue. Just lowering the corporate tax rates to make them competitive internationally, that would put us also in better situation relative to our global competitors. So I'm actually hopeful for tax reform. I think it will be a positive. I think it, in the long run, if it's structured right, it can be a positive for the even for the debt and the deficit.
We'll be following it closely, as will you, I know. My friend Kevin Freeman, thank you so much for joining us today and for the great work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy and also, of course, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Folks, check it out. Kevin, we'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Patrick Dunleavy about training our first lines of defense against the enemy within, including certain mosques. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Patrick Dunleavy. He formerly served as the Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections, capping a career in law enforcement and corrections that gave him insights into what is happening in our prisons that has to be considered among the most alarming of the examples of civilization jihad, and perhaps the precursor to much worse. He's chronicled all this in his terrific book, The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. He is these days an instructor in the United States Military Special Operations School, teaching them about terrorism in this country and beyond, and it is always a pleasure to have him with us to teach us a bit about what we should know, particularly about what's going on with jihad in jail. Patrick Dunleavy, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, my pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Before we get back to the jihad in jail topic, I did want to talk to you about a couple of other things you've been writing about recently, Patrick, and very importantly, I think, in the wake of this attack in New York City, you have expressed a concern that I think a lot of us feel, that the New York Police Department, one of the finest law enforcement organizations in the world, has been substantially handicapped, shall we say, by Mayor Bill de Blasio in connection with its monitoring of Sharia supremacist hotbeds, including mosques. Talk a little bit about that and what the implications are for law enforcement and public safety.
Sure. Well, one of the things that happened, just give a little background, after 9/11, I was assigned from my agency to work with the NYPD Counterterrorism and Intelligence Division, looking at radical Islamic influences, both in prison and on the street. One of the things we compiled was a list of mosques and Islamic centers where there was some suspicion of possibly having radical influences on not only inmates, but on other individuals. And we began to look at Muslim centers within the New York, New Jersey area. And that was a very successful program until sometime in early 2016, when Mayor de Blasio came in, that groups like the ACLU, as well as Muslim activist groups like CARE, came forward and complained about the practices that the police was doing in regard to investigating terrorism. They complained that they were being singled out, that Muslims were being profiled, that this had never been done before. And they looked specifically to a police report that had been authored by Mitch Silber and Arvin Blatt. And it was called Radicalization in the West, the Homegrown Threat. And it was a report on how the radicalization process could take place, not only how, but where it takes place, certain incubators, certain areas that law enforcement could look for. And again, that was just a basic police practice. We go back to looking at when we investigated the mafia and organized crime, Colombian drug cartels. You went to the neighborhoods where most could be victimized, were most susceptible to those type of influences. If we were looking at the mafia, we primarily went to an Italian neighborhood. If we went to look for Colombian drug cartels, we were going particularly to Hispanic neighborhoods.
Now, that wasn't because you were racist or you were, ethnophobic of some kind. It was because that's where these threats were emanating from, right?
It's so common sense that your listeners are going to recognize this immediately. If I get up in the morning, you get up in the morning, I need a clean shirt, I'm going to the closet. I'm not going to the refrigerator. So subsequently, if I'm looking for someone who may be an Islamic terrorist, I'm not going to go down to Chinatown and look for him. I'm going to go to a Muslim community. And this not only is police practice, but it's also been borne out historically. When we look at the 1993-1992 First World Trade Center attack and the conspirators there, most of them were going to mosques within the greater New York, New Jersey area. We had mosques in Brooklyn, Al-Farouk and Al-Taqwa, and in Jersey City, Masjid al-Salam, where the blind Sheikh Abdel Rahman went. So that was known. Now, we look at this particular case of Saipov, the Uzbeki, who rented a truck and drove down the west side of New York City, killing bikers and pedestrians. And we find that he lived right next to the Islamic Center, not the Islamic Center, but the Omar Mosque in Paterson, New Jersey. And the Omar Mosque had been one of those mosques that had previously come under surveillance and investigation by law enforcement for influences in terrorism.
But no more. And the larger point here, Patrick Dunleavy, has been that we've really seen over the years, whether it was de Blasio administration in New York City or whether it was the Obama administration in Washington, D.C., a systematic effort to hamper the law enforcement community as it was trying to do, as you say, that common sense and absolutely necessary job of protecting us. This came to be known in the national context, at least, Patrick Dunleavy, as the purge. Did you confront this purge and constraints upon the training and the kind of information that you were allowed to impart?
Yeah, and one of the things that you try to tell individuals is that not only is it bad police practice to kind of remove these type of buzzwords that people find offensive, but it also creates uncertainty in the law enforcement community where the line officer is afraid to put anything in a report that might be taken as offensive. And so then you have the officer walking on eggshells because he's afraid of what's going to come down. Instead of saying, the suspect was wearing a kufi and was carrying a copy of the Quran, I'm going to leave that out. I'm just going to say that he had a hat and he was carrying a book.
Let me turn finally with you, Patrick, to the topic we discussed mentioned at the beginning, and that is this phenomenon of jihad in jail. You've recently written about the underwear bomber who is serving hard time at the moment and who is unfortunately now using our legal system to try to create greater latitude for him. Among other things, it would appear to be able to proselytize jihad among his fellow prisoners. What is up with that? And just very quickly, what are the stakes of if this is allowed to happen?
Well, again, with Abdullah Matab, who was arrested Christmas coming into the United States on a flight to Detroit with an explosive in his BVDs. One of the things that he went into prison under special conditions, what they call special administrative measures, that controlled who he could visit, who could call on the phone, who could talk to him, his correspondent. All those things were put in place because officials had seen where individuals in prison who were terrorists were able to get out messages or get out and be involved in other terrorist attacks, even from their prison cells. So he goes to court and files a lawsuit, not only saying that it's cruel and unusual punishment, but he files under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act saying that because of his particular faith, he needs these particular freedoms to do. And again, this wasn't unique. Ramzi Youssef, one of the World Trade Center bombers in 93, filed a lawsuit under the same thing, as did John Walker Lynn, the American Taliban. And now we have this individual from the latest New York City arrest, Saipov, the Uzbeki. Hours after he was arrested, law enforcement gave him his Miranda rights. And once we assign those to him, individuals go into prison and they look for ways, we call it jailhouse lawyers, being jail wise, and they begin to file lawsuits based on what are normal conditions of confinement. I don't like the cell I'm in. I don't like that I can't eat this particular food. I don't like that I can't get out of my cell five times a day and meet with other Muslim inmates. So these are the dangers that we see in prisons as we're taking in more and more individuals arrested for terrorist crimes.
Yeah, and increasingly as we find them ministered to by Sharia supremacists, Muslim Brotherhood or otherwise. Patrick Dunleavy, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again very soon if you would. In the meantime, folks, check out his terrific book, The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection, and other work he is doing with Steve Emerson's Investigative Project on Terrorism. Next up, we'll talk with Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy about limited material support for terrorism. What is up with that? That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Kyle Scheidler. He is the director of the Center's Threat Information Office, a man who has come up through the ranks of the public policy analysis business, cutting his teeth in such terrific organizations as the Endowment for Middle East Truth. He has been doing incredibly important work, I believe, in assessing the magnitude of the jihadist threat, the Sharia supremacist threat, if you will, here inside the United States. And I wanted to talk with him a bit about some recent developments of a very important kind involving what's known as limited material support for terrorism. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us. Thank you as well for occasionally sitting in this chair and hosting for me in my absence, but I'm very grateful to you for giving me a chance to talk with you on that side of the microphone.
Well, Frank, it's always my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So what is limited material support for terrorism? And how does one differentiate it from just plain old-fashioned material support for terrorism?
So during the Obama administration in 2009, the Obama administration made the decision to create a policy that would allow refugees and other immigrants and asylum seekers entry to the United States if they engaged in material support for terrorism of only a quote-unquote limited nature. Now, what they meant by that was foreigners who had some kind of material support that was of a cultural or family nature, which included, for example, providing medical care, the exclusion of children and spouses of foreigners who were inadmissible terrorists to allow them to come into the country. And the decision that they made was to have all of these cases reviewed at the secretarial level. So it was Jay Johnson at the Department of Homeland Security that would make the final decision whether or not these individuals would come into the country, rather than the customs and enforcement agents that would ordinarily have made that decision, as was, for example, done under the Bush administration. Because there are exemptions that can be made for people if, for example, if terrorists burst into your house and demand all your money in exchange for your life, you know, that kind of support would not qualify because it's under duress. The problem, of course, is that it's very common for individuals to claim that they were under duress when in fact they weren't. So these are the kinds of decisions that you want made by trained law enforcement people. You don't want them made by political people at the secretary level. But that's what the Obama administration was doing. Now, fortunately for us, the Trump administration has essentially reversed that decision, which is good policy coming out of the Trump administration at DHS.
That is heartening indeed. But a sort of larger problem here, Kyle Scheidler, it seems to me, is this policy was the eventual realization, I guess, of a promise that President Obama made during his trip to Cairo back in 2009 when he declared to a room full of, among others, Muslim Brotherhood leaders that he was going to do something about zakat. Kyle, remind us what zakat is and why he felt the need to try to make it easier, I think is the way he put it, for American Muslims to engage in it.
Well, what you're referring to, Frank, is that 2009 Cairo speech by Obama, where he claimed that Muslim charities were suffering because of U.S. discrimination against the giving of zakat. Now, the only thing that he could have been referring to was U.S. counterterrorism efforts against terror finance, because, of course, the United States doesn't actually discriminate against people for giving charity. Now, the issue here comes from the nature of zakat, which is a sort of religious tithing required under Sharia. And depending on your school of jurisprudence, there are requirements for how that zakat should be spent. And one of those requirements is that some subsection of zakat should be given to fund jihad. That is zakat fi sabilillah, meaning in the cause of Allah. So this is essentially support for terrorism, but it's taking place under this sort of rubric of religious cultural practice. And so that's where we get into what we were talking about earlier with limited material support in the immigration sense, because they were defending this giving of zakat under the concept of it being simply a cultural practice, when in reality, there are, you know, a number of organizations that were prosecuted in this country for funding major terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and Hamas and Hezbollah, that were doing it under the rubric of zakat.
Well, and that brings me to a follow-on question. It would appear that because there are, of course, Sharia supremacists in this country who would be trying to make this sort of payment, zakat, for the prescribed purposes under Sharia, which include at least one and perhaps as many as four different uses that would serve the purposes of jihad. We've got a problem in this country, not just from people trying to get into it from elsewhere, do we not?
We do indeed. You know, Frank, it used to be fairly common for us folks that kind of track this behavior to see on the websites of Muslim Brotherhood-run organizations, groups like CARE and others, where it would actually, under their donation page, it would say, you know, donations to our organization are permissible as zakat under fi sabilillah. So what they are essentially saying is that in some way, giving to their organization will benefit the jihadist effort. Right. So, and we still see that to this day, although it's a little bit rarer because they sort of know that groups like the Center for Security Policy are watching.
Are monitoring them, indeed. If not law enforcement, which should be, heavens knows. Kyle, let me finally turn to a related topic. In terms of people in this country warning about what has been done in the name of Sharia supremacism, I think there are a few who are more prominent, more courageous, more admirable than Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She, of course, is the Somali expat who became a member of parliament in the Netherlands and was threatened with murder by a jihadist because of her opposition to Sharia, fundamentally, and has now made her way to this country where she is living under 24-hour police protection. I wonder, as it's her birthday, would you reflect with me on the fact that a few months ago, a mutual friend of ours, Rich Higgins, when he was on the National Security Council staff, sought to bring her into the NSC to brief the staff there on her experiences and findings with respect to Sharia supremacism, and was stopped by a fellow by the name of Mustafa Javed Ali, who serves as a member of the National Security Council staff responsible for counterterrorism. I'm told he insisted that she couldn't come in unless she was accompanied by a member of the organization you just mentioned, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a Hamas and Brotherhood Front organization. What light can you shed on this character, and why on earth he is at the National Security Council?
Well, Mustafa Javed Ali came up doing anti-terrorism, primarily anti-biochem terrorism stuff. He was CNN's terrorism advisor for a while, went into DHS and then later into the FBI. And there's been a number of troubling reports about his behavior at the NSC. For example, you mentioned the report that he had denied access or had conspired to deny access to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, which is really troubling because Ayaan's story, and particularly the focus that she puts on the role of organizations that engage in subversion and support for terrorism, even though they may not be jihadist organizations herself, is very important. And it's the kind of information that the folks at the NSC really need to be listening to. Reports that her admission would have been blocked are kind of deeply troubling. But it's been sort of the story of Mustafa Javed Ali at NSC. We've seen a number of reports that, you know, people take at different levels of value, but they've all been somewhat troubling.
We are following this closely thanks to your good work at the Center's Threat Information Office. Kyle Scheidler, I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.